Chapter 8. That afternoon, the flower vendor had called the offices of the Diario de Barcelona and left a message for Miquel, saying he'd seen the man we had described to him prowling around the old mansion like a ghost. It was past midnight when Miquel reached number 32 Avenida del Tibidabo. At night the place was a dark, deserted valley struck by darts of moonlight that filtered through the grove. Although he hadn't seen him for 17 years, Miquel recognized Julián by his light, almost cat-like walk, as his silhouette glided through the shadows of the garden, near the fountain. Julián had jumped over the garden wall and lay in wait by the house like a restless animal. Miquel could have called out to him, but he preferred not to alert any possible witnesses. He felt that furtive eyes were spying on the avenue from the dark windows of neighbouring mansions. He walked round the walls of the estate until he reached the part by the old tennis courts and the coach houses. There, he noticed the crevices in the wall that Julián must have used as steps, and the flagstones that had come loose on the top. He lifted himself up, almost out of breath, feeling an acute pain in his chest and experiencing periodic waves of blindness. He lay down on the wall, his hands shaking, and called Julián in a whisper. The silhouette that hovered by the fountain stood still, joining the rest of the statues. Miquel saw two shining eyes fixing on him. He wondered whether Julián would recognize him after 17 years and an illness that had taken away his very breath. The silhouette slowly came closer, wielding a long, shiny object in his right hand, a piece of glass.
Julián,
Miquel murmured. The figure stopped in its tracks. Miquel heard the piece of glass fall on the gravel. Julián's face emerged from the shadows. A 2-week stubble covered his features, which were sharper than they used to be. Miquel. Unable to jump down to the other side or even climb back to the street, Miquel held out his hand. Julián hauled himself onto the wall and, holding his friend's fist tightly with one hand, laid the palm of his other hand on his face. They gazed silently at one another for a long time, each sensing the wounds life had inflicted on the other.
We must leave this place, Julián. Fumero is looking for you. That business with Aldaya was a trap.
I know, murmured Carax in a monotone.
The house is locked. Nobody has lived here for years,
Miquel added.
Come on, help me down, and let's get out of here.
Carax climbed down the wall. When he clutched Miquel with both hands, he could feel his friend's wasted body under the loose clothes. There seemed to be no flesh or muscle left. Once they were on the other side, Carax gripped Miquel by the armpits, so that he was almost carrying him, and they walked off together into the darkness of Calle Román Macaya.
What is wrong with you? Whispered Carax.
It's nothing. Some fever. I'm getting better.
Miquel already gave off the smell of illness, and Julián asked no further questions. They went down León the 13th until they reached Paseo de San Gervasio, where they saw the lights of a café. They sought refuge at a table at the back of the room, away from the entrance and the windows. A couple of regulars sat at the bar smoking cigarettes and listening to the radio. The waiter, a man with a waxy pallor and downcast eyes, took their order. Warm brandy, coffee, and whatever food was available. Miquel didn't eat at all. Carax, obviously starving, ate for both of them. The two friends looked at each other in the sticky light of the café, spellbound. The last time they had seen each other face to face, they were half the age they were now. They had parted as boys, and now life presented one of them as a fugitive and the other with a dying man. Both wondered whether this was due to the cards they'd been dealt or to the way they had played them. I've never thanked you for everything you've done for me over the years, Miquel.
Don't begin now. I did what I had to do and what I wanted to do. There's nothing to thank me for.
How's Nuria?
The same as you left her.
Carax looked down.
We got married months ago. I don't know whether she wrote to tell you.
Carax's lips froze, and he shook his head slowly.
You have no right to reproach her for anything, Julian.
I know. I have no right to anything.
Why didn't you come to us for help, Julian?
I didn't want to get you into trouble.
That is out of your hands now. Where have you been all this time? We thought the ground had swallowed you.
Almost. I've been at home, in my father's apartment. Mikhail stared at him in amazement. Julian went on to explain how, when he arrived in Barcelona, unsure of where to go, he had set off towards his childhood home, fearing there would be nobody left there. The doors of the hat shop were still open, and an old-looking man with no hair and no fire in his eyes languished behind the counter. Julian hadn't wanted to go in, or let him know he'd returned. But Antoni Fortuny had raised his eyes and looked at the stranger on the other side of the window. Their eyes met. Much as Julian wanted to run away, he was paralyzed. He saw tears welling up in the hatter's eyes, saw him drag himself to the door and come out into the street speechless. Without uttering a word, he led his son into the shop and pulled down the metal grill. Once the outer world had been sealed off, he embraced him, trembling and howling with grief. Later, the hatter explained that the police had been round asking after Julian 2 days earlier. Someone called Fumero, a man with a bad reputation, who had supposedly been in the pay of General Joded's fascist thugs only a month before, and was now making out he was friends with the anarchists, had told him that Julian Carax was on his way to Barcelona, that he'd cold-bloodedly murdered Jorge Aldaya in Paris, and that he was sought for a number of other crimes, a catalogue that the hatter didn't bother to listen to. Fumero trusted that if by some remote and improbable chance his prodigal son made an appearance, the hatter would see fit to do his duty as a citizen and report him. Fortuny told Fumero that, of course, he could count on his help, though secretly it irritated him that a snake like Fumero should assume him to be so base. No sooner had the sinister cortege left the shop than the hatter set off towards the cathedral chapel where he had first met Sophie. There he prayed to his saint, begging him to guide his son back home before it was too late. Now that Julian had arrived, he warned him of the danger that awaited him.
Whatever has brought you to Barcelona, son, let me do it for you, while you hide in the apartment. Your room is just as you left it, and it's yours for however long you may need it.
Julian admitted that he'd returned to look for Penelope Aldaya. The hatter swore he would find her and that, once they had been reunited, he would help them both to flee to a safe place, far from Fumero, far from the past, far from everything. For days, Julian hid in the apartment in Ronda de San Antonio while the hatter combed the city looking for some sign of Penelope. Julian spent the days in his old room, which, as his father had promised, was unchanged, though now everything seemed smaller as if objects had shrunk with time. Many of his old notebooks were still there. Pencils he remembered sharpening the week he left for Paris, books waiting to be read, the boys' clean clothes in the cupboards. The hatter told Julian that Sophie had left him shortly after his escape, and although for years he didn't hear from her, she wrote to him at last from Bogota, where she had been living for some time with another man. They corresponded regularly.
"Always talking about you," the hatter admitted, "because it's the only thing that binds us."
When he spoke those words, it seemed to Julian that the hatter had put off falling in love with his wife until he had already lost her.
"You only love truly once in a lifetime, Julian, even if you aren't always aware of it."
The hatter, who seemed to be caught in a race against time to disentangle a whole life of misfortune, had no doubt that Penelope was that love of his son's life. Without realizing it, he thought that if he helped Julian recover her, perhaps he too would recover some part of what he had lost. That void that weighed on his bones like a curse. Despite his determination and much to his despair, the hatter soon discovered that there was no trace of Penelope Aldaya or of her family in the whole of Barcelona. A man of humble origins who had had to work all his life to stay solvent, the Hatter had never doubted the staying power of money and social station. But 15 years of ruin and destitution had been sufficient to remove mansions, industries, the very footprints of a dynasty from the face of the earth. When the name Aldaya was mentioned, there were many who had heard of it, but very few who remembered its significance. The day Michael Moliner and I went to the hat shop and asked after Julian, the hatter was certain we were two of Fumero's henchmen. Nobody was going to snatch his son away from him again. This time God Almighty could descend from the heavens, the same God who had spent his whole life ignoring the hatter's prayers, and Fortuny would gladly have pulled his eyes out if he dared to take Julian away again. The hatter was the man whom the flower vendor remembered seeing a few days before, prowling around the Aldaya mansion. What the flower vendor interpreted as pretty nasty was only the intensity that comes to those who, better late than never, have found a purpose in life and are pursuing it to make up for lost time. Unfortunately, the Lord once again disregarded the hatter's pleadings. Having crossed the threshold of despair, the old man was still unable to find what he needed for his son's salvation, for his own salvation, some sign of the girl. "How many lost souls do you need, Lord, to satisfy your hunger?" the hatter asked. God, in his infinite silence, looked at him without blinking. "I can't find her, Julian. I swear that..." "Don't worry, Father. This is something I must do. You've already helped me as much as you could." That night, Julian at last went out into the streets of Barcelona, determined to find Penelope. As Michael listened to his friend's tale, it did not occur to him to be suspicious of the waiter when he went over to the telephone and mumbled something with his back to them, or later, when he surreptitiously kept an eye on the door, wiping glasses too thoroughly for an establishment where dirt was otherwise so at home. It didn't occur to him that Fumero would already have been in that café, and in dozens of cafés like it, a stone's throw from the Aldaya mansion, that as soon as Carrack set foot in any one of them, the call would be placed in a matter of seconds. When the police car stopped in front of the café, and the waiter disappeared into the kitchen, Michael felt the cold and serene stillness of fate. Carrax read his eyes, and they both turned at the same time to see three grey raincoats flapping behind the windows, three faces blowing steam onto the windowpane. None of them was Fumero. The vultures preceded him.
"Let's leave this place, Julian."
"There's nowhere to go," said Carrax, with an oddly calm tone of voice that made his friend eye him carefully. It was only then that Michael noticed the revolver in Julian's hand. The doorbell sounded above the murmur of the radio. Michael snatched the gun from Carrax's hands and fixed his eyes on him.
"Give me your papers, Julian."
The three policemen pretended to sit at the bar. One of them gave Michael and Julian a sidelong glance. The other two felt inside their raincoats.
"Your papers, Julian, now!"
Carrack silently shook his head.
"I have only a month left, perhaps two with luck. One of us has to get out of here, Julian. You have more going for you than I do. I don't know whether you'll find Penelope, but Nuria is waiting for you."
"Nuria is your wife.
Remember the deal we made. The day I die, all that was once mine will be yours. Except your dreams."
They smiled at one another for the last time. Julian handed him his passport. Michael put it next to the copy of The Shadow of the Wind that he had been carrying in his coat pocket since the day he'd received it. "See you soon," Julian whispered.
"There's no hurry. I'll be waiting."
Just as the three policemen turned towards them, Michael rose from the table and went up to them. At first all they saw was a pale, tremulous man, who seemed to be at death's door as he smiled at them, blood showing in the corners of his thin, lifeless lips. By the time they noticed the gun in his right hand, Mikel was barely 3 yards away from them. One of them was about to scream, but the first shot blew off his lower jaw. The body fell on its knees, at Mikel's feet, lifeless. The other two police officers had already drawn their weapons. The second shot went through the stomach of the one who looked older, the bullet snapping his backbone in two and splattering a handful of guts against the bar. Mikel never had time to fire a third shot. The remaining policeman was already pointing his gun at him. He felt it in his ribs, on his heart, and saw the man's steely eyes lit up with panic.
"Stand still, you son of a bitch, or I swear I'll tear you apart!"
Mikel smiled and slowly raised his gun towards the policeman's face. The man couldn't have been more than 25, and his lips trembled.
"You tell Fumero from Carax that I remember his little sailor suit."
He felt no pain, no fire. The impact, like a muffled blow, threw him into the window, extinguishing the sound and colour of things. As he crashed through the pane, he noticed an intense cold creeping down his throat, and the light receding like dust in the wind. Mikel Molinaire turned his head for the last time and saw his friend Julian running down the street. Mikel was 36 years old, which was longer than he'd hoped to live. Before he collapsed onto a pavement strewn with blood-stained glass, he was already dead. Chapter 9. That night, an unidentified van arrived in response to the call from the policeman who had killed Mikel. I never knew his name, nor do I think he realized whom he had murdered. Like all wars, private or public, that one was like a stage show. Two men carried off the bodies of the dead policemen and made sure the manager of the bar understood that he must forget what had happened or there would be trouble. Never underestimate the talent for forgetting that wars awaken, Daniel. Mikel Molinaire's corpse was abandoned in an alleyway of the Rabaul quarter 12 hours later, so that his death could not be connected to that of the two police officers. When the body finally arrived at the morgue, it had been dead for 2 days. Mikel had left his own papers at home before going out. All the employees at the morgue could find was a disfigured passport in the name of Julian Carax and a copy of The Shadow of the Wind. The police concluded that the deceased man was Julian Carax. The passport still gave his address as Fortuny's apartment in Ronda de San Antonio. By then the news had reached Fumero, who went along to the morgue to bid farewell to Julian. There he met the hatter, whom the police had fetched to identify the body. Signor Fortuny, who hadn't seen Julian for 2 days, feared the worst. When he recognized the body as that of the man who had knocked on his door only a week earlier asking after Julian, and whom he'd taken to be one of Fumero's henchmen, he began to scream and left. The police took this response to mean he recognized the corpse. Fumero, who had witnessed the scene, went up to the body and inspected it silently. He hadn't seen Julian for 17 years. When he recognized Mikel Molinaire, all he did was smile and sign the forensic report confirming that the body in question was Julian Carax. He then ordered its immediate removal to a common grave in Montjuic. For a long time, I wondered why Fumero would do something like that. But that was simply Fumero's logic. By dying with Julian's identity, Mikel had involuntarily provided Fumero with a perfect alibi. From that moment on, Julian Carax didn't exist. There would be no official link between Fumero and the man who sooner or later he hoped to find and murder. It was wartime, and few would ask for explanations concerning the death of someone who didn't even have a name. Julian had lost his identity. He was a shadow. I spent 2 days in the apartment waiting for Mikel or Julian, thinking I was going mad. On the third day, Monday, I went back to work at the publishing firm. Signor Cabestani had been taken into hospital a few weeks previously and would not be returning to the office. His eldest son, Alvaro, had taken over the business. I didn't say anything to anyone. There was nobody I could turn to. That same afternoon, I received a call from an employee at the morgue, Manuel Gutierrez Fonseca. Señor Gutierrez Fonseca explained that the body of someone called Julian Carax had been brought into the morgue. Having compared the deceased man's passport with the name of the author of the book that was on the body when it arrived, and suspecting, moreover, if not a breach in the rules, a certain laxity on the part of the police, he had felt it his moral duty to call the publishers and inform them of what had happened. As I listened to him, I almost died. The first thing I thought was that it was a trap set up by Fumero. Señor Gutiérrez Fonseca expressed himself with the correct tones of a conscientious public official, although there was something else in his voice, something that even he would not have been able to explain. I had taken the call in Capistani's office. Thank God, Alvaro had gone out for lunch and I was alone. Otherwise, it would have been difficult for me to explain away my tears and the shaking of my hands as I held the telephone. Señor Gutiérrez Fonseca told me he had thought it appropriate to let me know what had happened. I thanked him for his call with the false formality of all such conversations. As soon as I put down the receiver, I closed the office door and bit my fists so as not to scream. I washed my face and left for home immediately, leaving a message for Alvaro to say I was unwell and would return the following day earlier than usual to catch up with correspondence. In the street, I had to make an effort not to run, to walk with the anonymous grey calm of people who have nothing to hide. When I inserted the key in the apartment door, I realised that the lock had been forced. I froze. The doorknob began to turn from within. I wondered whether I was going to die like this, in a dark staircase, and without knowing what had become of Mikael. The door opened, and I encountered the dark eyes of Julian Carax. May God forgive me, but at that moment I felt that life was returning to me, and I thanked the heavens for giving me back Julian instead of Mikael. We melted in a long embrace. When I searched for his lips, Julian moved away and lowered his eyes. I closed the door and, taking Julian's hand, led him to the bedroom. We lay together on the bed in silence. Evening was closing in and the shadows of the apartment were fringed with purple. As on every night since the start of the war, shots could be heard in the distance. Julian was crying as he lay on my chest, and I felt a tiredness beyond words. Later, once night had fallen, our lips met, and in the shelter of that pressing darkness we removed our clothes, which smelled of fear and of death. I wanted to remember Mikael, but the fire of those hands on my stomach stole all my shame and grief. I wanted to lose myself in them, even though I knew that at dawn, exhausted and perhaps overcome by contempt for ourselves, we would be unable to look each other in the eye without wondering what sort of people we had become. Chapter 10. I was woken by the pitter-patter of the rain at daybreak. The bed empty, the room bathed in grey light. I found Julian sitting in front of what had been Mikael's desk, stroking the keys of his typewriter. He looked up and gave me that lukewarm, distant smile that said he would never be mine. I felt like spitting out the truth to him, like hurting him. It would have been so simple, reveal to him that Penelope was dead, that he was living a lie, that I was now all he had in the world. I should never have returned to Barcelona, he murmured, shaking his head. I knelt beside him. What you are searching for is not here, Julian. Let's go away, the two of us, far from here, while there is still time. Julian looked at me for a long moment without blinking. You know something you haven't told me, don't you? He asked. I shook my head and swallowed. Julian just nodded. Tonight, I'm going back there.
Julian, please.
I must make sure.
Then I'll go with you.
No.
The last time I stayed here and waited, I lost Mikael. If you go, I go too.
This has nothing to do with you, Nuria. It's something that concerns only me. I wondered whether he didn't realize how much his words hurt me, or whether he just didn't care. That's what you think, I said. He tried to stroke my cheek, but I drew his hand away. You should despise me, Nuria. It would bring you better luck. Yes, I know. We spent the day outside, far from the oppressive darkness of the apartment that still smelled of warm sheets and skin. Julian wanted to see the sea. I went with him to La Barceloneta, and we walked along the almost deserted beach, the shimmering sand seeming to trail off into the summer haze. We sat on the sand near the shore, the way children or old people do. Julian smiled, saying nothing. As evening fell, we took a tram near the aquarium and went up Via Laietana to Paseo de Gracia, then on to Plaza de Lesseps and Avenida de la República Argentina until we came to the end of the route. Julian gazed silently at the streets, as if he were afraid of losing the city as we travelled through it. Halfway through our journey, he took my hand and kissed it without saying a word. He held it until we got off. An elderly man who was accompanied by a little girl dressed in white looked at us, smiling, and asked us whether we were engaged. It was dark by the time we walked up Calle Roman Macaya, towards the Aldaya's old mansion on Avenida del Tibidabo. A fine rain was falling, coating the thick stone walls with silver. We climbed the external wall at the back, near the tennis courts. The large, rambling house rose into view through the rain. I recognized it immediately. I had come across that house in a thousand different guises in Julian's books. In the red house, it was a sinister mansion that was larger inside than out. It slowly changed shape, grew new corridors, galleries, and improbable attics, endless stairs that led nowhere. It illuminated dark rooms that came and went from one day to the next, taking with it any unsuspecting individual who entered them, never to be seen again. We stopped outside the main door, locked with chains and a padlock the size of a fist. The large windows on the first floor were boarded up with wooden planks that were covered in ivy. The air smelled of weeds and wet earth. The stone, dark and slimy with rain, shone like the scales of a huge reptile. I wanted to ask Julian how he intended to get past that large oak door, which looked like the door of a basilica or a prison. Julian pulled a jar out of his coat and unscrewed the top. A fetid vapour issued from it, forming a slow bluish spiral. He held one end of the padlock and poured the acid into the lock. The metal hissed like red-hot iron, enveloped in a cloud of yellow smoke. We waited a few minutes, and then he picked up a cobblestone that lay among the weeds and split the padlock by banging it half a dozen times. Julian then gave the door a kick. It opened slowly, like a tomb, exhaling a thick, damp breath. Beyond the doorway, I could sense a velvety darkness. Julian had brought a benzene lighter, which he lit after taking a few steps into the entrance hall. I followed him, leaving the door behind us ajar. Julian walked on a few yards, holding the flame above his head. A carpet of dust lay at our feet, with no footprints but ours. The naked walls took on an amber hue from the flame. There was no furniture, no mirrors or lamps. The doors were still on their hinges, but the bronze doorknobs had been pulled out. The mansion was just a skeleton. We stopped at the bottom of the staircase. Julian looked up, his eyes scanning the heights. He turned around for a moment to look at me, and I wanted to smile, but in the half-light we could barely see each other's eyes. I followed him up the stairs, treading the steps on which Julian had first seen Penelope. I knew where we were heading, and I felt a coldness inside me that had nothing to do with the biting, damp air of that place. We went up to the third floor, where a narrow corridor led to the south wing of the house. Here the ceilings were much lower and the doors smaller. It was the floor of the servants' living quarters, The last room I knew without Julian having to tell me had been Jacinta Coronado's bedroom. Julian approached it slowly, fearfully. That had been the last place he'd seen Penelope, where he had made love to a girl barely 17 years old and who, months later, would bleed to death in that same cell. I wanted to stop him, but Julian had reached the doorway and was looking absent-mindedly inside. I peered into the room with him. It was just a cubicle, stripped of all ornamentation. The marks where a bed had once stood were still visible beneath the flood of dust that covered the floorboards. A tangle of black stains snaked across the middle of the room. Julian stared at the emptiness for almost a minute, disconcerted. I could see from his look that he hardly recognized the place, that the sight of it seemed like a cruel trick. I took his arm and led him back to the stairs.
"There's nothing here, Julian," I murmured. "The family sold everything before leaving for Argentina."
Julian nodded weakly. We walked down the stairs again. And when we reached the ground floor, Julian made his way to the library. The shelves were empty, the fireplace choked with rubble. The walls, a deathly pale, flickered in the breath of the flame. Creditors and usurers had managed to remove every last bit of it, most of which must be lost in the twisted heaps of some junkyard by now. "I've come back for nothing," Julian mumbled. Better this way, I thought. I was counting the seconds that separated us from the door. If I managed to get him away from there, we might still have a chance. I let Julian absorb the ruin of that place, purging his memories.
"You had to return and see it again," I said. "Now you know there's nothing here. It's just a large, old, uninhabited house, Julian. Let's go home."
He looked at me, pale-faced, and nodded. I took his hand, and we went along the passageway that led to the exit. The chink of outdoor light was only half a dozen yards away. I could smell the weeds and the drizzle in the air. Then I felt I was losing Julian's hand. I stopped and turned to see him standing motionless, his eyes staring into the darkness.
"What is it, Julian?"
He didn't reply. He was gazing, mesmerized, at the mouth of a narrow corridor that led towards the kitchen area. I walked over to him and looked into the shadows. The door at the end of the corridor was bricked up, a wall of red bricks laid roughly with mortar that bled out of the corners. I couldn't quite understand what it meant, but I felt an icy cold that took my breath away. Julian was slowly getting closer. All the other doors in the corridor, in the whole house, were open, their locks and doorknobs gone, all except this one.
"Julian, please, let's go."
The impact of his fist on the brick wall drew a hollow echo on the other side. I thought I saw his hands tremble when he placed the lighter on the floor and gestured for me to move back a few steps.
"Julian!"
The first kick brought down a rain of red dust. Julian charged again. I thought I could hear his bones breaking, but Julian was unperturbed. He banged against the wall again and again, with the rage of a prisoner forcing his way out to freedom. His fists and his arms were bleeding when the first brick broke and fell onto the other side. In the dark, with blood-stained fingers, Julian struggled to enlarge the gap. He panted, exhausted, possessed by a fury of which I would never have thought him capable. One by one, he loosened the bricks, and the wall came down. Julian stopped, covered in a cold sweat, his hands flayed. He picked up the lighter and placed it on the edge of one of the bricks. A wooden door carved with angel motifs rose up on the other side. Julian stroked the wooden reliefs as if he were reading a hieroglyph. The door yielded to the pressure of his hands. A glutinous darkness came at us from the other side. A little further back, the form of a staircase could be discerned. Black stone steps descended until they were lost in shadows. Julian turned for a moment, and I met his eyes. I saw fear and despair in them, as if he could sense what lay beyond. I shook my head,
begging him, without speaking, not to go down. He turned back, dejected, and plunged into the gloom. I looked through the brick frame and saw him lurching down the steps. The flame flickered, now just a breath of transparent blue.
Julian?
All I got was silence. I could see Julian's shadow, motionless at the bottom of the stairs. I went through the brick hole and walked down the steps. The room was rectangular with marble walls. It exuded an intense, penetrating chill. The two tombstones were covered with a veil of cobwebs that fell apart like rotten silk with a flame from the lighter. The white marble was scored with black tears of dampness that looked like blood dripping out of the clefts left by the engraver's chisel. They lay side by side, like maledictions, chained together. Penelope Aldaya, 1902 to 1919. David Aldaya, 1919. Chapter 11. I have often paused to think about that moment of silence and tried to imagine what Julian must have felt when he discovered that the woman he had been waiting 17 years for was dead, their child gone with her, and that the life he had dreamed about, the very breath of it, had never existed. Most of us have the good or bad fortune of seeing our lives fall apart so slowly we barely notice it. In Julian's case, that certainty came to him in a matter of seconds. For a moment I thought he was going to rush up the stairs and flee from that accursed place, and that I would never see him again. Perhaps it would have been better that way. I remember that the flame from the lighter slowly went out, and I lost sight of his silhouette. My hands searched for him in the shadows, and I found him trembling, speechless. He could barely stand, and he dragged himself into a corner. I hugged him and kissed his forehead. He didn't move. I felt his face with my fingers, but there were no tears. I thought that perhaps, unconsciously, he had known it all those years, that perhaps the encounter was necessary for him to face the truth and set himself free. We had reached the end of the road. Julian would now understand that nothing held him in Barcelona anymore, and that we could leave, go far away. I wanted to believe that our luck was about to change, and that Penelope had finally forgiven us. I looked for the lighter on the floor and lit it again. Julian was staring vacantly, indifferent to the blue flame. I held his face in my hands and forced him to look at me. I found lifeless, empty eyes, consumed by anger and loss. I felt the venom of hatred spreading slowly through his veins, and I could read his thoughts. He hated me for having deceived him. He hated Mikel for having wished to give him a life that now felt like an open wound. But above all, he hated the man who had caused this calamity, this trail of death and misery. Himself. He hated those filthy books to which he had devoted his life and about which nobody cared. He hated every stolen second. He looked at me without blinking, the way one looks at a stranger or some foreign object. I kept shaking my head, slowly, my hands searching his hands. Suddenly he moved away, roughly, and stood up. I tried to grab his arm, but he pushed me against the wall. I saw him go silently up the stairs. A man I no longer knew. Julian Carax was dead. By the time I stepped out into the garden, there was no trace of him. I climbed the wall and jumped down onto the other side. The desolate street seemed to bleed in the rain. I shouted out his name, walking down the middle of the deserted avenue. Nobody answered my call. It was almost 4 in the morning when I got home. The apartment was full of smoke and the stench of burnt paper. Julian had been there. I ran to open the windows. I found a small case on my desk with the pen I had bought for him years ago in Paris. The fountain pen I had paid a fortune for on the pretense it once had belonged to Victor Hugo. The smoke was oozing from the central heating boiler. I opened the hatch and saw that Julian had thrown copies of his novels into it. I could just about read the titles on the leather spines. The rest had turned to cinders. I looked on my bookshelves. All of his books were gone. Hours later, when I went to the publishing house in the middle of the morning, Alvaro Cabestany called me into his office. His father hardly ever came by anymore. The doctor said his days were numbered, as was my time at the firm. Cabestany's son informed me that a gentleman called Laïn Coubert had turned up early that morning, saying he was interested in acquiring our entire stock of Julian Carax's novels. The publisher's son told him we had a warehouse full of them in the Pueblo Nuevo district, but as there was such a demand for them, he insisted on a higher price than Coubert was offering. Coubert had not taken the bait and had marched out. Now Alvaro Cabestany wanted me to find this person called Laïn Coubert and accept his offer. I told the fool that Laïn Coubert didn't exist. He was a character in one of Carax's novels. That he wasn't in the least interested in buying his books. He only wanted to know where we stored them. Old Signor Cabestany was in the habit of keeping a copy of every book published by his firm in his office library, even the works of Julian Carax. I slipped into the room unnoticed and took them. That evening I visited my father in the cemetery of forgotten books and hid them where nobody, especially Julian, would ever find them. Night had fallen when I left the building. I wandered off down the Ramblas, and from there to La Barceloneta, where I made for the beach, looking for the spot where I had gazed at the sea with Julian. The pyre of flames from the Pueblo Nuevo warehouse was visible in the distance, its amber trails spilling out over the sea and spirals of smoke rising to the sky like serpents of light. When the firefighters managed to extinguish the flames shortly before daybreak, there was nothing left, just a brick and metal skeleton that held up the vault. There I found Luis Carbó, who had been the night watchman for 10 years. He stared in disbelief at the smouldering ruins. His eyebrows and the hairs on his arm were singed, and his skin shone like wet bronze. It was he who told me that the blaze had started shortly after midnight and had devoured tens of thousands of books until dawn came and he was faced with a river of ashes. Luis still held a handful of books he had managed to save. Some of Verdaguer's collected poems and 2 volumes of the history of the French Revolution. That was all that had survived. Various members of the Union had arrived to help the firefighters. One of them told me the firefighters found a burned body among the debris. At first they had assumed that the man was dead. But then one of them noticed he was still breathing, and they had taken him to the nearby Hospital del Mar. I recognized him by his eyes. The fire had eaten away his skin, his hands and his hair. The flames had torn off his clothes, and his whole body was a raw wound that oozed beneath his bandages. They had confined him to a room on his own at the end of a corridor, with a view of the beach, and had numbed him with morphine while they waited for him to die. I wanted to hold his hand, but one of the nurses warned me that there was almost no flesh under the bandages. The fire had cut away his eyelids. The nurse who found me collapsed on the floor crying asked me whether I knew who he was. I said I did. He was my husband. When a priest appeared to administer the last rites over him, I frightened him off with my screams. 3 days later, Julian was still alive. The doctor said it was a miracle, that his will to live gave him a strength no medicine could offer. They were wrong. It was not a will to live. It was hatred. A week later, when they saw that this death-bitten body refused to expire, he was officially admitted under the name of Michel Moliner. He would remain there for 11 months, always in silence, with burning eyes, without rest. I went to the hospital every day. Soon the nurses began to treat me less formally and invited me to lunch with them in their hall. They were all women who were on their own, strong women waiting for their men to return from the front. Some did. They taught me how to clean Julian's wounds, how to change his bandages, how to change the sheets and make a bed with an inert body lying on it. They also taught me to lose all hope of ever seeing the man who had once been held by those bones. 3 months later, we removed his face bandages. Julian was a skull. He had no lips or cheeks. It was a featureless face, the charred remains of a doll. His eye sockets had become larger and now dominated his face. The nurses would not admit it to me, but they were revolted by his appearance, almost afraid. The doctors had told me that as the wounds healed, a sort of purplish, reptile-like skin would slowly form. Nobody dared to comment on his mental state. Everyone assumed that Julian, Michel, had lost his mind in the blaze, and that he had survived thanks to the obsessive care of a wife who stood firm where so many others would have fled in terror. I looked into his eyes and knew that Julian was still in there, alive, tormenting himself, waiting. He had lost his lips, but the doctors thought that the vocal cords had not suffered permanent damage, and that the burns on his tongue and larynx had healed months earlier. They assumed that Julian didn't say anything because his mind was gone. One afternoon, 6 months after the fire, when he and I were alone in the room, I bent over him and kissed him on the brow. "I love you," I said. A bitter, harsh sound emerged from the dog-like grimace that was now his mouth. His eyes were red with tears. I wanted to dry them with a handkerchief, but he repeated that sound.
"Leave me,"
he said.
"Leave me."
2 months after the warehouse fire, the publishing firm had gone bankrupt. Old Cabestany, who died that year, had predicted that his son would manage to ruin the company within 6 months. An unrepentant optimist to the last. I tried to find work with another publisher, but the war did away with everything. They all said that hostilities would soon cease and things would improve. But there were still 2 years of war ahead, and worse was yet to come. 1 year after the fire, the doctors told me that they had done all that could be done in a hospital. The situation was difficult, and they needed the room. They recommended that Julian be taken to a sanatorium, like the hospice of Santa Lucia. But I refused. In October 1937, I took him home. He hadn't uttered a single word since that. "Leave me." Every day I told him that I loved him. I set him up in the armchair by the window, wrapped in blankets. I fed him with fruit juices, toast and milk, when there was any to be found. Every day I read to him for a couple of hours, Balzac, Zola, Dickens. His body was beginning to fill out, and soon after returning home, he began to move his hands and arms. He tilted his neck. Sometimes when I got back, I found the blankets on the floor and objects that had been knocked over. One day I found him crawling on the floor. Then, a year and a half after the fire, I woke up in the middle of a stormy night and found that someone was sitting on the bed stroking my hair. I smiled at him, hiding my tears. He had managed to find one of my mirrors, although I'd hidden them all. In a broken voice, he told me he'd been transformed into one of his fictional monsters, into Lain Kubert. I wanted to kiss him, to show him that his appearance didn't disgust me. But he wouldn't let me. He would hardly allow me to touch him. Day by day he was getting his strength back. He would prowl around the house while I went out in search of something to eat. The savings Michel had left me kept us afloat.
but soon I had to begin selling jewellery and old possessions. When there was no other alternative, I took the Victor Hugo pen I had bought in Paris and went out to sell it to the highest bidder. I found a shop behind the military government buildings where they took in that sort of merchandise. The manager did not seem impressed by my solemn oath that the pen had belonged to Victor Hugo, but he admitted it was a marvellous piece of its kind and agreed to pay me as much as he could, bearing in mind these were times of great hardship. When I told Julian that I'd sold it, I was afraid he would fly into a rage. All he said was that I'd done the right thing, that he'd never deserved it. One day, one of the many when I'd gone out to look for work, I returned to find that Julian wasn't there. He didn't come back until daybreak. When I asked him where he'd been, he just emptied the pockets of his coat, which had belonged to Mikhail, and left a fistful of money on the table. From then on, he began to go out almost every night. In the dark, concealed under a hat and scarf with gloves and raincoat, he was just one more shadow. He never told me where he went, and he almost always brought back money or jewellery. He slept in the mornings, sitting upright in his armchair with his eyes open. Once I found a penknife in one of his pockets. It was a double-edged knife with an automatic spring. The blade was marked with dark stains. It was then that I began to hear stories in town about some individual who was going around at night smashing bookshop windows and burning books. Other times the strange vandal would slip into a library or a collector's study. He always took two or three volumes, which he would then burn. In February 1938, I went to a second-hand bookshop to ask whether it was possible to find any books by Julian Carax on the market. The manager said it wasn't. Someone had been making them disappear. He had owned a couple himself and had sold them to a very strange person, a man who hid his face and whose voice he could barely understand.
Until recently, there were a few copies left in private collections, here and in France, but a lot of collectors are beginning to get rid of them. They're frightened, he said, and I don't blame them.
More and more, Julian would vanish for whole days at a time. Soon his absences lasted a week. He always left and returned at night, and he always brought back money. He never gave any explanations, or if he did, they were meaningless. He told me he'd been in France, Paris, Lyon, Nice. Occasionally, letters arrived from France addressed to Lain Coubert. They were always from second-hand booksellers or from collectors. Someone had located a lost copy of Julian Carax's works. Like a wolf, he would disappear for a few days, then return. It was during one of those absences that I came across Fortuny, the hatter, wandering about in the cathedral cloister, lost in his thoughts. He still remembered me from the day I'd gone with Mikhail to inquire after Julian 2 years before. He took me to a corner and told me confidentially that he knew that Julian was alive somewhere, but he suspected that his son wasn't able to get in touch with us for some reason he couldn't quite figure out.
Something to do with that cruel man, Fumero.
I told him that I felt the same. Wartime was turning out to be very profitable for Fumero. His loyalties shifted from month to month, from the anarchists to the communists, and from them to whoever came his way. He was called a spy, a henchman, a hero, a murderer, a conspirator, a schemer, a saviour, a devil. Little did it matter, they all feared him. They all wanted him on their side. Perhaps because he was so busy with the intrigues of wartime Barcelona, Fumero seemed to have forgotten Julian. Probably, like the hatter, he imagined that Julian had already escaped and was out of his reach. Signor Fortuny asked me whether I was an old friend of his son's, and I said I was. He asked me to tell him about Julian, about the man he'd become, because he sadly admitted he didn't really know him.
Life separated us, you know.
He told me he'd been to all the bookshops in Barcelona in search of Julian's novels, but they were unobtainable. Someone had told him that a madman was looking for them in every corner of the city and then burning them. Fortuny was convinced that the culprit was Fumero. I didn't contradict him.
Whether through pity or spite, I lied as best I could. I told him I thought that Julian had returned to Paris, that he was well, that I knew for a fact he was very fond of Fortuny the Hatter, that he would come back to see him as soon as circumstances permitted.
"It's the war," he complained. "It just rots everything."
Before we said goodbye, he insisted on giving me his address and that of his ex-wife, Sophie, with whom he was back in touch after many years of misunderstandings. Sophie now lived in Bogota with a prestigious doctor, he said. She ran her own music school and often wrote asking after Julian.
"It's the only thing that brings us together now, you see. Memories. We make so many mistakes in life, young lady, but we only realize this when old age creeps up on us. Tell me, are you religious?"
I took my leave, promising to keep him and Sophie informed if I ever had any news from Julian.
"Nothing would make his mother happier than to hear how he is. You women listen more to your heart and less to all the nonsense,"
the Hatter concluded sadly.
"That's why you live longer."
Despite the fact that I heard so many appalling stories about him, I couldn't help feeling sorry for the poor old man. He had little else to do in life but wait for the return of his son. He seemed to live in the hope of recovering lost time through some miracle of the saints, whom he visited with great devotion at their chapels in the cathedral. I'd become used to picturing him as an ogre, a despicable and resentful human being. But all I could see before me was a kind man, blind to reality, confused like everybody else. Perhaps because he reminded me of my own father, who hid from everyone, including himself, in that refuge of books and shadows, or because the Hatter and I were also linked by the hope of recovering Julian. I felt a growing affection for him and became his only friend. Unbeknownst to Julian, I often called on him at the apartment in Ronda de San Antonio. The Hatter no longer worked in his shop downstairs.
"I don't have the hands, or the sight, or the customers," he would say.
He waited for me almost every Thursday and offered me coffee, biscuits, and pastries that he scarcely touched. He spent hours reminiscing about Julian's childhood, about how they worked together in the hat shop, and he would show me photographs. He would take me to Julian's room, which he kept as immaculate as a museum, and bring out old notebooks and everyday objects without ever realizing that he'd already shown them to me before, that he'd told me all those stories on a previous visit. He seemed to be reconstructing a past that had never existed. One of those Thursdays, as I walked up the stairs, I ran into a doctor who had just been to see Fortuny. I asked him how the Hatter was, and he looked at me strangely.
"Are you a relative?"
I told him I was the closest the poor man had to one. The doctor then told me that Fortuny was very ill, that it was just a matter of months.
"What's wrong with him?"
"I could tell you it's his heart, but what is really killing him is loneliness. Memories are worse than bullets."
The Hatter was pleased to see me and confessed that he didn't trust that doctor. "Doctors are just second-rate witches," he said. All his life, the Hatter had been a man of profound religious beliefs, and old age had only reinforced them. He saw the hand of the devil everywhere. "The devil," he said, "clouds the mind and destroys mankind."
"Just look at this war. Oh, look at me. Of course, I'm old now and weak. Oh, but as a young man, I was rotten. A coward."
It was the devil who had taken Julian away from him, he added.
"God gave us life, but the world's landlord is the devil."
And so we passed the afternoon, nibbling on stale sponge fingers and discussing theology. I once told Julian that if he wanted to see his father again before he died, he'd better hurry up. It turned out that he, too, had been visiting the Hatter, without his knowing from afar, at dusk, sitting at the other end of a square, watching him grow old. Julian said
He would rather the old man took with him the image of the son he had created in his mind during those years than the person he had become. "You keep that one for me," I said, instantly regretting my words. He didn't reply, but for a moment it seemed as if he could think clearly again and was fully aware of the hell into which we had descended. The doctor's prognosis did not take long to come true. Signor Fortuny didn't live to see the end of the war. He was found sitting in his armchair, looking at old photographs of Sophie and Julian. The last days of the war were the prelude to an inferno. The city had lived through the combat from afar, like a wound that throbs dully with months of skirmishes and battles, bombardments and hunger. The spectacle of murders, fights and conspiracies had been corroding the city's heart for years, but even so, many wanted to believe that the war was still something distant, a storm that would pass them by. If anything, the wait made the inevitable even worse. When the storm broke, there was no compassion. Nothing feeds forgetfulness better than war, Daniel. We all remain silent, and they try to convince us that what we've seen, what we've done, what we've learned about ourselves and about others is an illusion, a nightmare that will pass. Wars have no memory, and nobody has the courage to understand them until there are no voices left to tell what really happened, until the moment comes when we no longer recognize them and they return with another face and another name to devour everything they left behind. By then, Julian hardly had any books left to burn. His father's death, about which we never spoke, had turned him into an invalid. The anger and hatred that had at first possessed him were spent. We lived on rumours, secluded. We heard that Fumero had betrayed all the people who had helped him advance during the war and was now in the service of the victors. It was said that he was personally executing his main allies in the cells of Montjuic Castle. His preferred method, a pistol shot to the mouth. The heavy mantle of collective forgetfulness seemed to descend around us the day the weapons went quiet. In those days I learned that nothing is more frightening than a hero who has lived to tell his story, to tell what all those who fell at his side will never be able to tell. The weeks that followed the fall of Barcelona were indescribable. More blood was shed during those days than during the combat, but secretly, stealthily. When peace finally came, it was the sort of peace that haunts prisons and cemeteries, a shroud of silence and shame that rots the soul. There were no guiltless hands or innocent looks. Those of us who were there, all without exception, will take the secret with us to the grave. A faint patina of normality was being restored, but by now Julian and I were living in abject poverty. We had spent all the savings and the booty from Lane Coubert's nightly escapades, and there was nothing left in the house to sell. I looked desperately for work as a translator, typist or cleaner, but it seemed that my past association with Cabestany had marked me out as undesirable. People were suspicious. A government employee in a shiny new suit, with brilliantined hair and a pencil moustache, one of the hundreds who seemed to crawl out of the woodwork during those months, hinted that an attractive girl like me shouldn't have to resort to such mundane jobs. Our neighbours accepted my story that I was taking care of my poor husband Mikel, who had become an invalid and was disfigured as a result of the war. They would bring us offerings of milk, cheese or bread, sometimes even salted fish or sausages that had been sent to them by relatives in the country. After months of hardship, convinced that it would take a long time to find a job, I decided on a strategy borrowed from one of Julian's novels. I wrote to Julian's mother in Bogota, adopting the name of a fictitious new lawyer whom the deceased Signor Fortuny had consulted in his last days when he was trying to put his affairs in order. I informed her that, as the Hatter had died without having made a will, his estate, which included the apartment in Ronda de San Antonio and the shop situated in the same building, was now theoretically the property of her son Julian, who, it was believed, was living in exile in France. Since the death duties had not been satisfied, and since she lived abroad, the lawyer, whom I christened José María Requejo in memory of the first boy who had kissed me in school, asked her for authorization to start the necessary proceedings and carry out the transfer of the properties to the name of her son, whom he intended to contact through the Spanish embassy in Paris. In the meantime, he was assuming the transitory and temporary ownership of the said properties, as well as a certain level of financial compensation. He also asked her to get in touch with the manager of the building and instruct him to send all the documents, together with the payment for the property expenses, to Signora Checo's office, in whose name I opened a P.O. box with a fake address, that of an old disused garage 2 blocks away from the ruins of the Aldaya mansion. I was hoping that, blinded by the possibility of being able to help Julian and getting back in contact with him, Sophie would not stop to question all that legal gibberish and would agree to help us, especially in view of her prosperous situation in far-off Colombia. A couple of months later, the manager of the building began to receive a monthly money order to cover the expenses of the apartment in Ronda de San Antonio and the fees of José María Requejo's law firm, which he proceeded to send as an open check to P.O. Box 2321 in Barcelona, just as Sophie Carax had requested him to do. The manager, I noticed, retained an unauthorized percentage every month, but I preferred not to say anything. That way, he whetted his beak and did not question such a convenient arrangement. With the money that remained, Julian and I had enough to survive. Terrible bleak years went by, during which I managed to find occasional work as a translator. By then, nobody remembered Cabestany, and people began to forgive and forget, putting aside old rivalries and grievances. But I lived under the perpetual threat that Fumero might decide to begin rummaging in the past again. Sometimes I convinced myself that it wouldn't happen, that he must have given Julian up for dead by now, or forgotten him. Fumero wasn't the thug he was years ago. Now he had graduated into a public figure, an ambitious member of the fascist regime who couldn't afford the luxury of hunting Julian Carax's ghost. Other times I woke up in the middle of the night with my heart pounding, covered in sweat, thinking that the police were hammering on my door. I feared that some of the neighbours might begin to be suspicious of that ailing husband of mine who never left the house, who sometimes cried or banged the walls like a madman, and that they might report us to the police. I was afraid that Julian might escape again, that he might decide to go out hunting for his books once more. Distracted by so much fear, I forgot that I was growing old, that life was passing me by, and that I had sacrificed my youth to love a man who was now almost a phantom. But the years went by in peace. Time goes faster the more hollow it is. Lives with no meaning go straight past you, like trains that don't stop at your station. Meanwhile, the scars from the war were, of necessity, healing. I found some work in a couple of publishing firms and spent most of the day out of the house. I had lovers with no name, desperate faces I came across in cinemas or in the metro, with whom I would share my loneliness. Then, absurdly, I'd be consumed by guilt. And when I saw Julian again, I always felt like crying and would swear to myself that I would never betray him again, as if I owed him something. On buses or in the street, I caught myself looking at women who were younger than me, holding small children by the hand. They seemed happy or at peace, as if those helpless little beings could fill all the emptiness in the world. Then I would remember the days when, fantasizing, I had imagined myself as one of those women, with a child in my arms, Julian's child. And then I would think about the war and about the fact that those who waged it had also been children once. I had started to believe that the world had forgotten us when someone turned up one day at our house. He looked young, barely a boy, a novice who blushed when he looked me in the eye. He asked after Miquel Moliner and said he was updating some file at the School of Journalism. He told me that Signor Moliner might be the beneficiary of a monthly pension, but if he were to apply for it, he would first have to update a number of details. I told him that Signor Moliner hadn't been living there since the start of the war, that he'd gone abroad. He said he was very sorry and went away, leering.
He had the face of a young informer, and I knew that I had to get Julian out of my apartment that night without fail. By now he had almost shriveled up completely. He was as docile as a child, and his whole life revolved around the evenings we spent together, listening to music on the radio, as he held my hand and stroked it in silence. When night fell, I took the keys of the apartment in Ronda de San Antonio, which the manager of the building had sent to a non-existent Signora Quejo, and accompanied Julian back to the home where he had grown up. I set him up in his room and promised him I'd return the following day, reminding him to be very careful. "Fumero is looking for you again," I said. He made a vague gesture with his head, as if he couldn't remember who Fumero was, or no longer cared. Several weeks passed in that way. I always went to the apartment at night, after midnight. I asked Julian what he'd done during the day, and he looked at me without understanding. We would spend the night together, holding each other, and I would leave at daybreak, promising to return as soon as I could. When I left, I always locked the door of the apartment. Julian didn't have a copy of the key. I preferred to keep him there like a prisoner, rather than risk his life. Nobody else came round to ask after Mikel, but I made sure the rumour got about in the neighbourhood that my husband was in France. I wrote a couple of letters to the Spanish consulate in Paris saying that I knew that the Spanish citizen Julian Carax was in the city and asking for their assistance in finding him. I imagined that sooner or later the letters would reach the right hands. I took all the precautions, but I knew it was only a question of time. People like Fumero never stop hating. The apartment in Ronda de San Antonio was on the top floor. I discovered that there was a door to the roof terrace at the top of the staircase. The roof terraces of the whole block formed a network of enclosures separated from one another by walls just a yard high, where residents went to hang out their laundry. It didn't take me long to locate a building at the other end of the block, with its front door on Calle Joaquin Costa, to whose roof terrace I could gain access and therefore reach the Ronda de San Antonio building without anyone seeing me go in or come out of the property. I once got a letter from the building manager telling me that neighbours had heard sounds coming from the Fortuny apartment. I answered in Requejo's name, stating that occasionally a member of the firm had gone to the apartment to look for papers or documents, and there was no cause for alarm, even if the sounds were heard at night. I added a comment implying that, among gentlemen, accountants and lawyers, a secret bachelor pad was no small treasure. The manager, showing professional understanding, answered that I need not worry in the least, that he completely understood the situation. During those years, playing the role of Signora Quejo was my only source of entertainment. Once a month I went to visit my father at the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. He never showed any interest in meeting my invisible husband, and I never offered to introduce him. We would skirt around the subject in our conversations, like expert mariners dodging reefs near the water's surface. Occasionally he asked me whether I needed any help, whether there was anything he could do. On Saturdays at dawn, I sometimes took Julian to look at the sea. We would go up to the roof, cross over to the adjoining building, and then step out into Calle Joaquin Costa. From there, we made our way down towards the port, through the narrow streets of the Raval Quarter. We never encountered anyone. People were afraid of Julian, even from a distance. At times, we went as far as the breakwater. Julian liked to sit on the rocks facing the city. We could spend hours like that, hardly speaking. Some afternoons we'd slip into a cinema, when the show had already started. In the dark, nobody noticed Julian. As the months went by, I learned to confuse routine with normality, and in time I came to believe that my arrangement was perfect. What a fool I was.